Support for this IPR podcast comes from Iowa Community Foundations, an initiative of the Iowa Council of Foundations, connecting donors to causes they care about. Details on the Endow Iowa Tax Credit Program at communityfoundations.org.
It's your Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, in our news, we've been hearing a lot of concern about the integrity of our election, specifically about the next presidential election in 2024. Well, this week, a member of the University of Iowa faculty testified before a congressional committee in Washington. He joins us now. Derek Muller is the Bauma Fellow in Law and Professor of Law at the University of Iowa College of Law. He teaches classes in election law and federal courts. Derek, welcome back to our program.
Oh, thanks for having me.
This week, you offered your expertise regarding the Electoral Count Reform Act of 2022. Before we get to what that act actually does, give us some background. What are the concerns about the Electoral College system?
Sure. So when we vote for president every year, it's actually a very complicated system. We vote in November. There's a canvas and a count of the ballots, and then in mid-December, presidential electors gather and meet and cast their votes for president, and those are submitted to Congress on January 6th, which gathers to count them. And obviously, January 6th, 2021, a riot took place at the Capitol, and we saw all the fallout from that. So one of the things that Congress is looking at is what fomented these things, what gave people the thought that state legislatures could undo elections, or that Congress could throw out votes, or the vice president could throw out votes. And so this is an effort to address those problems and the problems that we have in a lack of confidence in the election results or second-guessing election outcomes.
Yeah. So what was the problem? January 6th, of course, you'll hear some, you know, the former vice president said there is no ambiguity. But tell us, is there ambiguity in the law as it exists and goes back decades to what, to the 1800s, right?
Yeah. So after the election of 1876, there was a really big fight in Congress about what to do, because multiple states submitted competing sets of presidential electoral votes, and Congress created a commission. It was bitterly divided, and they never wanted that to happen again. So they passed this act to try to simplify the counting of electoral votes. And there have been some theories about, well, who does the counting, or what are the bases for not counting electoral votes? And one of those, you pointed out, was this question about the vice president. And Vice President Pence looked at what the vice president had done, who presides in the joint session of Congress, and it's pretty much a ministerial role, opening envelopes, calling for objections, moving things along. But if you squint hard enough, there are a couple of instances where the vice president has exercised some discretion in the past. And really, there was an allegation that maybe this was some inherent constitutional authority of the vice president. Mike Pence rejected that claim on January 6th. And so one of the things that this bill would do is try to tighten that up to emphasize there's no constitutional authority here for the vice president to disregard votes, to throw out votes, to send it back to the states to investigate. So again, it's just one of the things that they're trying to tighten up ahead of the 2024 election.
Mm-hmm. And even if you squint, though, you have to consider, don't you, Derek, that the idea that one person, namely a vice president, could overturn an entire election is absurd, isn't it? Even in the law.
I mean, I think so. I think when you think about how this is set up, it's actually not technically the vice president. In the Constitution, it's set up as the president of the Senate, who's typically the vice president. But early on, we didn't actually have a mechanism until the 1960s for replacing a vice presidential vacancy when the vice president became president or if the vice president died. So often that would devolve to one member of Congress, the member of the Senate. The president pro tempore of the Senate presides over the Senate when the vice president is absent or if there is no vice president. So it's even more absurd, right, that we think Congress might have this power together joined to make an adjudication. But the argument otherwise would say, well, if Congress doesn't have it, one senator has it, if not one vice president, right? That's a tremendous amount of authority that, yeah, just seems to strain against the structure of checks and balances in our Constitution.
Okay, so this week you testified before what committee in Washington, and what was your message, or what were you asked about?
Yeah, it was the Senate Rules Committee, which is considering a bill that was put forward by a bipartisan group of 16 senators, 9 Republicans and 7 Democrats. It was a working group led by Senator Susan Collins of Maine and Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia, but includes a broad and diverse range of voices along the political spectrum who have joined this effort. And so the Rules Committee, this is sort of the first step of Congress considering a bill. And this is a committee led by Senator Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota and Senator Roy Blunt of Missouri. And so this was an opportunity to talk to some experts and get some feedback about this reform proposal that these 16 senators had put forward.
Yes, and you are an expert on election law. What questions were you asked and what messages did you want to drive home based on your expertise?
Well, I wanted to emphasize that whenever you're trying to reform election laws, and especially rules like this, you want to have bipartisan buy-in. You want to have confidence in the future that people are going to abide by these results and that these rules are in place not to affect or advantage one party or another. But we want neutral rules before we know what the problem arises. And so really emphasizing that this is a great effort. And then highlighting a number of things that the bill does. The bill emphasizes that Election Day is only in November and that there's no opportunity for legislatures to meet afterwards and pick a different slate of electors, as some state legislators had suggested they could. It tries to firm up the deadline for appointing a set of electoral votes from the state in mid-December so that there's not litigation dragging into January and in the future. And it gives us the confidence of saying when Congress meets, it knows there's one true result, that if state courts or federal courts have looked at the results, that they're supposed to defer to those findings. And when Congress meets, in the past, it's only required one member of the Senate, one member of the House to file an objection, which forces everyone into 2 hours of debate. So there were two objections that were filed in 2021, one related to Arizona, one related to Pennsylvania. It's, you know, with the riots, it's a reason why the counting went into 3 a.m. on the morning of January 7th. So the goal is to raise that threshold to require 1/5 of the members of each chamber, so 20 senators and around 87 members of the House. So it makes it much harder to delay the processing of votes. So at each stage of the process, it just offers more stability, more clarity, more precision. And that's what I was describing to members of this committee.
Mm-hmm. This is in the initial phases in this committee. How much bipartisan support you think is there? Do you think overall?
I mean, I think everyone, or I shouldn't say everyone, but just about everyone wants to get something done. They realize there are problems and weaknesses. You know, Democrats have objected in the past to election results in 2001 and 2005 and 2017. There are some ambiguities that have been stretching back for 200 years, really, about how to define Election Day. And so I think everyone realizes that this is a moment where if these weaknesses were particularly exploited in 2020, if it sowed doubt, if it gave rise to frivolous litigation, that there's a moment to fix these things, again, on a bipartisan basis moving into 2024. Senator Mitt Romney pointed out, he said, this is not the kind of bill we want to get 60 votes, you know, that it's 50 and 10. It's the kind of bill you want 80 or more votes in the Senate. So I think the goal is to find that common ground and bipartisan consensus. And so far, I think they've been achieving it.
Yeah. Any word or anything you know about Iowa's congressional delegation, how those members feel about it?
Well, some good reporting from the Des Moines Register this week, you know, asked Senator Grassley about it. And he indicated that he'd read about the bill, although he hadn't read the bill itself, and indicated that he was at least generally in support of it. So it's, you know, again, the devil's in the details, and you can find out when someone reads the bill. But that's the first and I think strongest statement from one of the Iowa delegation in support of the bill.
Yeah. Derek Mueller, what would a failure to reach agreement on this bipartisan measure mean potentially if we went into 2024 with the same law we've had since you described how it was introduced in the 1800s?
Yeah, I think, you know, a lot of the weaknesses of the Electoral Count Act, which, you know, we've kind of papered over the years or haven't necessarily meant the difference in an election, came to the surface in 2020 in unique ways. And I think people now are acutely aware of those ambiguities and will potentially seek to exploit them in 2024 to suggest that legislatures can show up after Election Day, declare that an election has failed, and choose their own slate of electors. that more members of Congress will be prepared to object and to delay the counting of votes and delay the processing. So there are just these weaknesses that we know are there. Again, they've sort of been under the surface and just bubbling up over the years. But once they've come to a head, it's really incumbent on Congress to address it and leave some serious weaknesses in the system by 2024 if we don't really prepare for it.
We heard this week in the news, of course, Republicans touting former President Trump's unfounded claims that the 2020 election was stolen. We saw them, you know, with victories across the map in Tuesday's primaries. Several of those winning the primaries are vying for Secretary of State positions in their respective states, some in swing states, in fact, where they would have, I think, their hands on the levers of the state's election system. Does this federal act, if passed, would it address the danger of having election deniers elected to state office?
So it does address one point in particular, which is the concern if a governor or a secretary of state who's empowered to certify the election results just refuses to sign or signs the results for the losing party claiming it's the winning party. This act would help emphasize that first, Congress is not supposed to give deference to that if there's later federal or state judicial action, lawsuits that say, no, 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 you got it wrong. This is the true certificate. And Congress is instructed to treat that certificate that the court comes up with as conclusive if there's been some problem from the governor's side. Additionally, if the governor does have some problem or refuses to certify the election, it provides, within a few days of when the Electoral College meets, the opportunity for an expedited judicial review where it goes to a 3-judge federal panel and then to the United States Supreme Court. So states already have some mechanisms in place to handle these things. There's something called the writ of mandamus where courts can instruct officials to follow the law when it's just a ministerial obligation where they have no discretion. They can also order someone else to do it if that executive official refuses to do it. So there are some state mechanisms in place. But the Electoral Count Reform Act tries to tighten that up, at least in this domain, right? Just really dealing with sending certificates of election to Congress and makes it much tougher to deny the people's will once they voted.
Mm-hmm. Okay. A lot of nuance here. I'm glad you're explaining it. But in short, should this pass, as you see it there in the bill with its safeguards there, is this an absolute foolproof prevention of hijacking of our elections?
I won't say foolproof, but I will say it certainly strengthens our elections. It gives more confidence at every stage of the process from Election Day itself all the way up to when Congress meets. And so at every stage, it offers, again, that sort of clarity and stability that we want. It doesn't try to do new or innovative things because you really want to provide as much stability as possible. And these need to be setting guardrails for the existing system that we have. So again, I spoke out in support of it. You know, there are a couple of technical problems that people might have at the very margins and that I think the committee is going to look at to figure out, well, should we tweak the language here and emphasize this there? But I was supportive of it, and there have been a lot of supporters, bipartisan group of law professors, a bipartisan group of the prestigious American Law Institute of distinguished legal practitioners and academics, and publications left, right, and center have come out with their editorial boards in support of it. So I think it's in a good place, and I think we'll see what happens in the weeks ahead as the committee considers this.
All right. Thank you for your expertise. Derek Mueller testified this week before a congressional committee in Washington about the Electoral Count Reform Act of 2022. Derek Mueller on the faculty of the University of Iowa College of Law. Thanks again, Derek. Bye now.
Bye.
It's your News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, a new report issued yesterday by the U.S. Drought Monitor shows an area of expanding drought in parts of Iowa. Let's get details from our Western Iowa reporter, Kendall Crawford. Hi, Kendall.
Hi, Ben.
What can you tell us about the latest drought conditions?
Yeah, so like you said, this drought monitor is really showing an expansion of drought, which shouldn't be a surprise to some people who've been kind of monitoring this. We've seen kind of that area grow and grow with every week of drought that we're seeing. But in this last week, what we're seeing a lot more of is moderate drought. So basically, that has grown by around 10% since just last week. And we're seeing that mostly in southern Iowa, that growth there, as well as just seeing continued drought in some of the areas that we've seen before. So that's especially northwest Iowa, which is facing the worst of it. They currently have the second most severe classification, which is extreme drought. So that area has kind of been seeing that red, that color we don't want to see on a drought monitor since around June, as well as just kind of dealing with drought on and off for the last 2.5 years.
Right. It's dry. I'm in the southeast part of the state. It's dry here. I know the ground is getting very hard and cracked in some areas, but even worse where you are in northwest Iowa. So what can you tell us about the rest of the state? The whole state hit? Are there any places that are receiving, are not considered in drought conditions?
Yeah, luckily, when you look at the map, it's not all covered in drought. So the areas of northeast Iowa are pretty much spared. It doesn't look like a lot of drought is there. But the more west you go, the more yellow and orange and red you're basically going to see on the map. And luckily, thinking about this time last year, we're not in the same situation that we were then, which was 3/4 of the state was covered in drought. We're a little under that right now. So we're about 60% of the state has some sort of classification of drought right now.
I want to ask you about the forecast, what we can see from this vantage point. But before that, how is this affecting crops, especially in the western and northwestern parts of the state?
Yeah, so I've spoken to some farmers around here, and they're just telling me that they're starting to see signs of heat stress. So that looks like the corn leaves curling or soybean leaves turning over. And of course, some fields are saying looking more spared than others. But the general consensus is that, we're starting to see crop deterioration. The crop report for this week showed the state corn rated around 76%. And that's down a little bit from last week, where it sat at 80%. But really, kind of the threat that we're facing right now with crops is that it's a really important time period for crop development right now. And so if it gets too dry, more corn will see this kernel abortion, which is not good. And then for soybeans, they're at a point where they're blooming and they're trying to set pods, which isn't easy to do when you have these dry conditions. And just for some context on like how dry we're talking, 69% of the topsoil moisture in this area and 65% of the subsoil moisture is inadequate right now. So that means they're not moist enough. So basically what we're seeing is the vast majority of the area isn't holding enough water for these crops.
Well, according to our weather forecasters, is there any hope for relief in the coming weeks?
There's hope. That's the conversation that I had with the state climatologist, is that there's always hope and never to give that up. It's always helpful to get, these timely rains during these periods. But really what we want is, in this area, at least 2 inches, best 4 inches. And that's just not looking like it's in the forecast right now. Predictions are that the drought's going to get worse before it gets better. So August is usually the peak drought time. So next week and the next one, we're likely to see just the drought worsen. For context, in this area, June is typically the wettest month. But this June, actually, that we just had was the second driest on record, and that's since 1896. So we're seeing a very low level of precipitation that we need to make up for. And we're probably not going to see that until the fall, because right now the August predictions aren't looking like they're going to help us all too much.
And we know that a lot of this extreme weather, whether it's too dry, too hot, or too wet, can be due to climate change. And you reported this week also on a new major at Iowa State University. You can actually now major in climate science. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it's super cool because it's really one of a kind in the state and in the nation, really. There's other programs that kind of focus on climate, but none that are exactly kind of based in the climate science like this one is going to be. One of the cool things about it is that you'll study climate science, but you'll get to pick a different track based on what you're interested in. So you can pick from advanced climate science, you can do data visualization, you can do planning for sustainability, you can do policy, communication, agriculture. It's really just however you think that you want to use the climate sciences to kind of think of climate change solutions in the future.
Yeah, and I think you spoke with some ISU students who are doing this new major, and I wonder what they had in mind for what they were going to do in terms of a career after they were awarded the major.
Yeah, so they're really excited to get started on this. And while the two students that I spoke to didn't have a specific thing in mind, both of them told me that they see kind of their mission here, their purpose is to help solve climate change or however that looks like. And so one of the students I talked to, incoming freshman, Daniel Musel, he's actually really interested in the communication side of it, which I thought was super interesting because, you know, we learn all this climate science, but we really need to learn to communicate that to the layperson like me or you. Like, we need to be able to, you know, tell people about the science and then think of solutions that way. And so he was really excited about that portion of it. The other student I talked to, Junior Owen Halverson, he was basically really excited about just the flexibility that this kind of offers him. So if he in the future decides he wants to go into policy and try to write, you know, climate change policy, he could do that. Or, you know, if he wanted to work for a town, he could help design sustainable, you know, planning for that town. Or, you know, maybe he does the left turn and wants to go to the private sector. There's opportunities for, you know, companies like insurance companies to get climate advice. I mean, that's something more and more industries are looking for right now, especially as we see, you know, more extreme conditions with our weather.
Okay, Kendall Crawford. Sounds exciting at ISU. IPR's Western Iowa reporter, Kendall Crawford, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Coming up after a short break, another edition of What Dennis Found in the Basement, featuring, oh, get this, an archive recording of Bing Crosby singing about Iowa. We'll also groove into the weekend. It's your Friday News Buzz. I'm Ben Kiefer. Back in just a moment.
Support for this IPR podcast comes from Iowa Community Foundations, an initiative of the Iowa Council of Foundations, connecting donors to causes they care about. Details on the Endow Iowa Tax Credit Program at communityfoundations.org. Support for IPR comes from The Healing Room at Upstream Functional Medicine, offering medical spa services that support the body's natural ability to detoxify from environmental challenges. Learn more about The Healing Room at upstreamfm.com.
It's your Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In just a few moments, Dennis Reese and Tim Walsh will be along with another edition of What Dennis Found in the Basement. That's our celebration of a century of radio in Iowa. But first, the time, last weekend, the setting, Hy-Vee Arena in Kansas City, Missouri, the event, the Granny Basketball National Championships. Joining me today, members of the team that came out on top last weekend. They are members of the Cedar Rapids Sizzlers, Diana Marker and Virginia McFadden. Welcome and congratulations.
Thank you so much.
I wonder, Diana or Virginia, if you'd like to give a shout out to the other team members on this championship team before we talk about the games a little bit.
Oh, I'd love to. They are Sue Callahan, Lola Reisner, Kathy Snow, Linda Jennings, Michelle Kraft, Virginia McFadden, Margaret Buter, Susan Hartley, Trish Spear, and Jen Neubauer.
All right. Very happy, I'm sure, since last weekend's championship. Your team won all six of its games over the weekend, the field consisting of 20 teams, I understand, representing six states, not only Iowa, but Missouri, Kansas, Oklahoma, Texas, and Louisiana. One of you, take us back to a moment during the championship last weekend that stands out in your memory, a moment in one of the games.
How about you, Virginia?
For me, the biggest moment was in our very first game. We started out really poorly and got behind, and it was like, oh, what are we doing? And then we just pulled ourselves together and came back and actually won the game by nearly 20 points. And I think that was a moment when we all saw that, hey, we can really do this. So let's just keep it going.
Yeah, you pulled together as a team. Diana, is that your favorite moment too?
Oh, I can't pick a favorite. Just making it through, yes.
Okay. Give us a sense of how granny basketball is played. Help us picture it. I understand one of the missions here is to preserve the history of six-on-six basketball.
I would like to talk about that. Granny basketball is not like the regular basketball that people of Cedar Rapids are used to watching. It's based on the six-on-six game that was so popular in the 60s and 70s in the small towns. And in Cedar Rapids, they did not actually have girls basketball in the high schools until Title IX forced them to in like 1972. So they don't have the nostalgia here that we have, that the people have in the smaller towns. All our players played in smaller towns in Iowa and end up moving as adults. But these players are, a lot of them were the leaders in their communities, their schools, their churches, their nonprofits. They're the doers. And sometimes they're even the pioneers, because like one of our players started 6-on-6 basketball at her high school. She recruited a coach. They petitioned the school board. So I'm trying to give you kind of a taste for the kind of spirit, the kind of commitment that our players have.
Yeah, so playing today is like going back. Do you feel like do you feel like kids again, a little bit like teenagers playing? Does it take you back to those early years?
I'll let you answer this one, Virginia.
Yes, it really does. It is like getting a second childhood. I think all of us on our team just really love to play basketball, and it's a chance to do that in a competitive environment. A little bit different style, but you know, it just feels good to play.
What are some issues that you as older basketball players have to deal with that younger players might not have to? How is basketball different as you age?
Well, the rules are different. No running, no jumping. The jumping, it's pretty obvious. You don't want players landing on top of other players. And we do have players up to 80 and 90 years old.
Wow.
And
mm-hmm.
You might think that they don't have skills. They do have skills. A lot of them have been playing, you know, they started playing in the 50s, 60s, and, you know, and have been playing for like 15 years. And you're not going to say to your teammate, oh, you're too old to play now. That's you integrate them into the game, you know, you keep them integrated into the game, and they're so much fun to be around. You know, this is for fun, and it's for the not, and our purpose is to raise money for nonprofits, and our nonprofit that we raise money for is the Meals on Wheels program in Cedar Rapids, and we are very proud to help out this very worthy organization.
Well, we're so happy to celebrate your championship and all the worthy causes that you stand for there at Granny Basketball. Diana Marker, Virginia McFadden, two members of the national champion Cedar Rapids Sizzlers. They won the championship last weekend in Kansas City, Missouri. And next year's tournament, I understand, will be at Luther College in Decorah. I guess you'll be looking to retain your title, huh, Diana and Virginia?
Of course.
All right.
Always the goal.
Yes.
All right. You're never too old to play basketball. Diana and Virginia, take care. Keep that training and those skills up, okay?
Okay. Thank you so much.
It's your Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. And now, once again, to celebrate the centennial of radio in Iowa, we continue our series, What Dennis Found in the Basement. And once again, our guests, presidential historian Tim Walz, you know him well on our airwaves, also former IPR Midday host Dennis Reese. If you haven't been following us, just a reminder, Dennis has been volunteering his time to go through the trove of all kinds of artifacts, memorabilia from the early days of radio that are stored in the basement of the IPR studios in Iowa City. And each of these episodes, Dennis hauls up something. Sometimes it's not very heavy at all, a little pamphlet or a record or something like that, a book to discuss something interesting that he has discovered in our series, What Dennis Found in the Basement. Dennis and Tim, welcome to back to our series.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
I have to ask, Dennis, what do you have for this episode from the basement?
Well, in this case, Ben, it's a document called the Iowa State College Press Authors, a series of radio programs broadcast by station WOI and sponsored by Iowa State College Press. Of course, Iowa State University was known as Iowa State College back then. I wasn't sure if it was a hugely important find, but then I thought, here's a comprehensive document listing a series of programs broadcast right at the beginning of World War II, 1942. It's clear a lot of effort went into the series. Looks like their plans to continue it into 1943 didn't pan out. For one thing, the document makes clear that the 21 half-hour programs were recorded, which was not easy in 1942. They have had to have cut large 16-inch electrical transcription discs, very expensive and time-consuming, and then someone had to transcribe the interviews from the booklet. Now, I haven't been able to locate the actual recordings. They may be down there, but I'm not done with my project. The Iowa State College Press must have been fairly new at the time. There were about 60-some books in its catalog. The first interview in the series was with Harold Engel, manager of the Iowa State College Press. The interviews were conducted by Charles Rogers, chair of the Iowa State College Press Board of Directors. Now, the thought that occurred to me when I first discovered this nicely produced booklet downstairs was this just blatant promotion of the press by a non-commercial educational radio station?
Mm-hmm.
Now, Engel was actually the first interview in the series. He makes clear to Rogers that his organization needs and wants to sell books. So he emphasizes, though, that they are nonprofit. I don't think that the present-day Iowa Public Radio would do this sort of series for, let's say, the University of Iowa Press. Not that we haven't interviewed some of the authors
over
yet, but not in a format that is strictly dedicated to a weekly broadcast devoted to the press. At any rate, one can't question the fact that the interviews were educational and informative, although some sort of weird and technical stuff there, not exactly Terry Gross material. Now, Tim and I have read through the booklet and found our favorites. One thing that was totally lacking in the series was humor. Sorry about that. But you can't have everything. And I don't think humor was a big part of public radio 80 years ago.
Okay, so as a historian, Tim Walz, what interests you about this document from 1942?
What's important about it is that it represents, on the part of Iowa State College, an effort to reach out again to the general public. And if you look at the catalog of interviews, and in fact the catalog of books that Dennis referred to, they are largely practical and technical manuals intended for people in specialty work here in Iowa, maybe across the Midwest. The idea as a land-grant institution that they were producing useful knowledge. And so the press, really, as an extension of the useful knowledge that was going on campus, was to produce these in book form to be sold to farmers and technical specialists around the state. And so that's the type of book that they presented in a physical form, in book form, on paper. But, of course, they could use WOI to reach out to that audience to let them know, by the way, that there was such a book. Because in many cases, the local farmer might not be aware of it if he doesn't get a daily newspaper or something like that. So this was outreach. And, by the way, this type of outreach was common at most universities. Now, the University of Iowa did not have a press at that point, I don't believe. But Harvard, Johns Hopkins, all of the major research institutions also produced books like this. Often they were dissertations produced by the graduate students. In this case, most of the books, then the titles, we'll read a few of these titles, were produced, I think, by faculty members or specialists on campus.
No access to recordings of this right now, but we are talking 1942, so very rudimentary recording technology. But you're going to pick a few of the more interesting interviews you found and read some excerpts here.
Yeah, we'll do this briefly. Why don't you start, Tim?
Dennis mentioned, of course, that the first interview was with Harold Engel, who was the manager of the press, that is the chief honcho there, and then followed by the superintendent of printing. I'm sure the interview, I have not read that interview, but it has to do with a technical manufacturer of books. But the third one was logical, and in fact, they make reference to it, which was an interview with Earl Ross, who was a professor of history at Iowa State University College at the time, and it was his History of the College, published in 1942. This remains an important book in the historiography, as we say, the study of history of higher education. And so I'm just going to read a little bit of the interview here. It says, this is the interviewer speaking.
We are in our third number of these chats with Iowa State College authors, and yet not until this afternoon do we have our first author. Well, that won't seem too queer to you if you have heard us last week and the week before. For we started the series with friends of the Iowa State College authors. Last week we had the superintendent of printing, Bill Holmes, and the week before that we met editor Harold Engel. That explains why our first Iowa State College author is on the third program of the series. You meet a historian today, Dr. Earl D. Ross of the College History staff. There's a good deal of pertinency in having Dr. Ross with us. In the first place, he is the author of a book bearing the challenging title, Democracy's College. In these times, the very concept of democracy itself is being defended by American boys in sea, air, and land war. Democracy's College has come to have a special meaning since Pearl Harbor.
And then he goes on from there. So it's an interview with Earl Ross.
Interesting. Yes. And 1942, maybe a year or two after Pearl Harbor. And we're right in the thick of it.
I'm guessing, a few months actually after Pearl Harbor. The book obviously was published not in anticipation of war per se, but it showed the importance of higher education in the whole process of developing a well-educated citizenry.
Mm-hmm. And here's my favorite. An interview with Frank C. Pellett of Atlantic, Iowa. His book, A History of American Beekeeping. That's right. Charles Rogers begins the interview.
All over the world, wherever honeybees are kept, Frank C. Pellett's name is a byword. Mr. Pellett has written 5 books on bees. His latest book, History of American Beekeeping, was published by the Iowa State College Press. This is the first history of beekeeping, at least the first in the English language. Its wildflower preserve at Atlantic, Iowa, takes a lot of his spring and summertime, and all year long he's a working member of the staff of the American Bee Journal. Mr. Pellett, the beekeeper, has this to say. Men have kept bees for their honey for more than 200 years, but strangely enough, until recently, they know no better way to get it than to kill the bees and strain out the honey from the broken combs. The bees were hived in hollow logs or skeps made of straw. There was no way to remove the combs except by cutting them out, and the beekeeper knew but little about the activity of the insects on which he depended for his supply of sweets. Little progress was made until the Langtroth invention in 1851. The loose-hanging frame made it possible to remove any comb at will, and the beekeeper could reach any part of the hive and ascertain just what was taking place there. From that time, progress has been rapid, and beekeeping soon changed from an insignificant sideline to a commercial specialty. Beekeepers who own from 1,000 to as many as 10,000 colonies of bees are now very common, and instead of counting the output in pounds, they now speak of the number of carloads that the crop of honey represents.
Now that is fascinating that at one time, before this invention, you would have had to just massacre the bees to get at your honey.
That's right.
Oh,
that's
my.
Right. I didn't know that, did you?
No.
Mountains and mountains of information that may not be of any value to the, at the present day. But when you look down this list of 21 titles that are represented in these interviews, and I assume that these were selected because the staff at WOI said this is reaching a big potential audience, and you look at these titles, and there's careers in a book called Careers in Engineering, Requirements and Opportunities, or a book on agricultural finance, one on farm records, technical journalism. How about animal breeding plans or the secretion of milk? These were all published volumes that were eventually sold to farmers and to other specialists around the country. That's the function of a university press.
Tim Walsh and Dennis Reese, thank you for giving us another edition of What Dennis Found in the Basement. We're looking forward to what you bring us next week. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Okay. I-O-A, that's how they sing it in the tall corn song. Other people call it I-O-A.
Well, we've come to the end of this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, and it is already August 5th. Grooving us into this new month is Mark Simmet of IPR Studio One. Hi, Mark.
Hey, Ben.
I see you have a couple of really nice tunes to groove us into the weekend, starting with a hard-driving and powerful blues voice, right?
Yeah, Shamika Copeland. She's been around for a while. She has a new album coming out in mid-August, a follow-up to her album from a couple years ago, which won a Grammy. And the album will be out in mid-August, but there is a single out right now. And it's a very socially conscious single, still hard-driving, but the lyrics have to do with the continuing struggle for civil rights. And Sonny Landreth contributes some great slide guitar on this one. It's called Too Far to Be Gone.
A small thing like a seat on a bus changed life for the rest of us. A tiny woman that you never met put us on the road, but we ain't there yet. A brave soul is long gone, but a spirit's marching on.
I love that sound, Mark. I hear at the beginning there a lyrical ode to Rosa Parks, and no, the civil rights movement is not completed. And
right. And I wanted to mention Shamika Copeland will be in Iowa at the Bourbon and Blues Festival in Cedar Rapids on August 20th.
All right. We have time for one more to take us out. What do you have?
Well, this is a band that currently is number one on the in the non-commercial radio world. On the charts that we have, keeping track of these sorts of things. It's a band called Mama, and that's spelled M-O-M-M-A. This is a real good summertime song, I think. It's all about driving around aimlessly listening to music, and I think we've all probably done that from time to time. It's called Speeding 72.
Different time.
love that tune, Aimlessly Driving Around to Clear Your Head. Love it. A trio there, right, Mark?
Yeah, trio from Los Angeles and aimlessly driving around, but they also do mention buckling up in the lyrics, which I thought was a nice touch.
All right, and let's put them in an e-car while we're there. All right, we'll go out with this tune by Mama, Speeding 72. Thanks, Mark Simmet of IPR Studio One. The best in new music and old favorites, courtesy of our friends at IPR Studio One. Take care, Mark.
Thanks, Ben.
That does it for today. Today's program produced by Samantha McIntosh. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Why don't you put some aimless driving on your agenda for the weekend? I'm Ben Kiefer. Have a great one.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.